our pastor, Mr. Walker. Afternoon to all of you. And I forgot one of the... I believe that's the only thing I forgot. Well, as you probably know, events in the Middle East have been a focus of world news for quite some time. Certainly the U.S. involvement in Iraq is in the news daily, along with the bombing, suicide bombings, all the terrible things that are happening over there. Although a lot of good things are happening, too. Those don't tend to make the news because they don't sell newspapers quite as well. But at any rate, that's been in the news every day. The nuclear threat in Iran has certainly been a major news item recently in particular. The war between Israel and Lebanon, which now has a temporary ceasefire, emphasis probably on temporary, and of course also ongoing terrorist threats. More recently, as you probably know, a major terrorist attack was discovered and thwarted. This involved a plan to bomb 10 airline flights originating in Britain and flying to the United States. What could these have to do with Bible prophecy? You know, we've tended to focus on Europe as the major staging area for end-time prophecy, but what about the Middle East? No, isn't that important as well, and even perhaps more so? How could events in the Middle East fulfill end-time Bible prophecy? One possible answer has to do with another source of prophecy, and that's Muslim belief. I don't know how many of you saw this, but there was an article written by the Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University that was actually in the Wall Street Journal opinion journal, it's called here. And this has been quoted in a number of locations. This is the actual article itself from the Wall Street Journal. I'm going to read it to you. The man's name is Bernard Lewis, who is the, as I said, Professor Emeritus of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. During the Cold War, both sides possessed weapons of mass destruction, but neither side used them, deterred by what was known as MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. In other words, it's sort of a balance of terror, they called it. Both sides had nuclear warfare, and they just realized, look, we can't use these because we'll wipe each other out. Similar constraints have no doubt prevented their use in the confrontation between India and Pakistan. In our own day, a new such confrontation seems to be looming between a nuclear-armed Iran and its favorite enemies, named by the late Ayatollah Khomeini as the Great Satan and the Little Satan, that is, the United States and Israel. Against the U.S., the bombs might be delivered by terrorists, the method having the advantage of bearing no return address. Against Israel, the target is small enough to attempt obliteration by direct bombardment. It seems increasingly likely that the Iranians either have or very soon will have nuclear weapons at their disposal, thanks to their own researches, which began some 15 years ago, to some of their obliging neighbors, and to the ever-helpful rulers of North Korea. The language used by Iranian President I'm going to have difficulty with this because it's Ahmadinejad, I believe the emphasis is on the last syllable there. Anyway, what would seem to indicate the reality and indicate the imminence of this threat. Would the same constraints, the same fear of mutual assured destruction restrain a nuclear-armed Iran from using such weapons against the U.S. or against Israel? There is a radical difference between the Islamic Republic of Iran and other governments with nuclear weapons. The difference is expressed in what can only be described as the apocalyptic worldview of Iran's present rulers. This worldview and expectation, vividly expressed in speeches, articles, and even school books, clearly shaped the perception and therefore the policies of Ahmadinejad and his disciples. Even in the past, it was clear that terrorists claiming to act in the name of Islam had no compunction in slaughtering large numbers of fellow Muslims. A notable example is blowing up of the American embassies in East Africa in 1998, killing a few American diplomats and a much larger number of uninvolved local passersby, many of them Muslims. There were numerous other Muslim victims in the various terror attacks of the last 15 years. The phrase, Allah will know his own, is usually used to explain such apparently calloused unconcern. It means that while infidel, that is, non-Muslim victims, will go to a well-deserved punishment in hell, Muslims will be sent straight to heaven. According to this view, the bombers are in fact doing their Muslim victims a favor by giving them a quick pass to heaven and its delights, the rewards without the struggles of martyrdom. School textbooks tell young Iranians to be ready for a final global struggle against an evil enemy named as the U.S. and to prepare themselves for the privileges of martyrdom. See, we don't realize what the different mindset. I mean, we're not dealing with people who treasure life, who value life. they so this mutual balance of terror doesn't work anymore with these folks. Going on, as I said, the answer may lie in Muslim prophecy. This the article goes on to make the point with regard to that. In Islam, as in Judaism and Christianity, there are certain beliefs concerning the cosmic struggle at the end of time. Gog and Magog, Antichrist, Armageddon, and for the Shiite Muslims, the long-awaited return of the hidden Imam, ending in the final victory of the forces of good over evil, however these may be defined. Mr. Ahmadinejad and his followers clearly believe that this time is now, and that the terminal struggle has already begun and is indeed well advanced. It may even have a date indicated by several references by the Iranian president to giving his final answer to the U.S. about nuclear development by August 22nd. That's next Tuesday, by the way, this coming Tuesday. This was at first reported as, quote, by the end of August, unquote, but Mr. Ahmadinejad's statement was more precise. What is the significance of August 22nd? This year, August 22nd corresponds in the Islamic calendar to the 27th day of the month of Rajab of the year 1427. This, by tradition, is the night when many Muslims commemorate the night flight of the Prophet Muhammad on the winged horse Barak, first to the farthest mosque, usually identified with Jerusalem, and then to heaven and back. This is from some of the writings cited here. This might well be deemed an appropriate date for the apocalyptic ending of Israel and, if necessary, of the world. It is far from certain that Mr. Ahmadinejad plans any... I'm going to call him Mr. A from now on, if you don't mind. That just doesn't connect with me. So this may well connect anyway with him. This is the point here. So it is far from certain that Mr. A plans such cataclysmic events precisely for August 22nd, but it would be wise to bear the possibility in mind. A passage from the Ayatollah Khomeini quoted an 11th grade Iranian school book is revealing. Quote, I am decisively announcing to the whole world that if the world devourers, that is the infidel powers in their way of thinking, wish to stand against our religion, we will stand against their whole world and will not cease until the annihilation of all of them. Either we will all become free, or we will go to the greater freedom which is martyrdom. Either we shake one another's hands in joy at the victory of Islam in the world, or all of us will turn to eternal life in martyrdom. In both cases, victory and success are ours. That's a scary mindset. You know, I mean, this is similar to World War II. Remember the kamikaze pilots? But the kamikaze pilots were individuals that tried to crash their planes into a ship. We're dealing with a nation here that has nuclear warfare, and it has the same belief, so it's the worst of both worlds. In this context, mutual assured destruction, the deterrent that worked so well during the Cold War, would have no meaning. At the end of time, there will be general destruction anyway. What will it matter? Or what will matter will be the final destination of the dead, hell for the infidels and heaven for the believers. For people with this mindset, mad is not a constraint, it's an inducement. So, you know, I mean, the bottom line is they really believe this. I mean, many people in the United States today supposedly believe in going into heaven, but they're in no hurry to get there, right? People want to enjoy this life. This is not true with these people. They are dead serious in more ways than one, literally and figuratively, about their beliefs. And the sooner the better, as far as they're concerned. They got nothing to lose. You know, if they win, like you said, if they win the military victory, that's great. If they die in martyrdom, that's even better, because they go to paradise right away. Well, the question is raised here, how then can one confront such an enemy with such a view of life and death? Well, I'll get to that here in a moment. But before I read that, I want to share something else with you that might make the hairs on your neck stand up. Remember I mentioned about that terrorist plot that was foiled? This is from the Daily Telegraph in London. The title of the article is Fake Sports Drink Plot Would Have Killed Thousands. Thousands of people would have died in the air and on the ground on, guess what date, August 22nd. If the terrorists managed to carry out an evil plan to use liquid bombs disguised as sport drinks to bring down the transatlantic aircraft. Alarmed British security chiefs launched emergency raids to follow the plotters after intercepting a message from a possible ringleader in Pakistan, which said, do your attacks now. That's why they went ahead and interrupted it when they did. But it goes on to say, here in the quote, this is a police deputy commissioner Paul Stevenson said, we are confident we have disrupted a plan by terrorists to cause untold death and destruction. Put simply, this was intended to be mass murder on an unimaginable scale. Unimaginable to us, but not to, you know, the terrorists who think totally different than us. British intelligence sources said the plotters had originally planned August 22nd as attack day, but brought forward a test run after two British nationals were arrested in Pakistan about a week ago. So what the message intercepted probably was, do the test run now. But the officials didn't want to take a chance, so they jumped in and caught these guys long before. But the original date was August 22nd. And again, that we read the significance of that date. The British would-be bombers are accused of planning to bring down planes over American cities, possibly including New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, or Miami. U.S. sources said as many as five would-be bombers could still be on the run. But U.K. sources said they'd apprehended the major players. British security sources said the bombers were yet to select the exact flights they would target, but had focused on United, Continental, and American Airlines. The suicide bombers are believed to have been planning to use a recipe for explosives similar to that used by Al-Qaeda and dubbed Mother of Satan. So, you know, you might want to stay close to home on Tuesday. Who knows? I mean, these guys still might carry out this plot. There's five of them still missing. They could still jump on planes. I wouldn't want to be flying out of Britain on Tuesday, I'll tell you that for sure. You know, this was uncovered because apparently, as I recall the story, some relative of one of the terrorists heard about it and went to authorities. But you know, all the authorities in the subject of terrorism say it's not a question of if terrorists will strike the U.S. again, it's a question of when. And we apparently dodged a bullet once again. Maybe. But maybe if there are five others out there, still, they still might get on planes and try to pull something off on this meaningful to them date of August 22nd. Another thing, I don't have a quote with me, but I heard this on a TV program. I saw it on the internet at a time or two as well. But and that is that some foreign minister in Iran was promising Israel a surprise on August 22nd. And people think that that might be some sort of perhaps nuclear warfare that might be perpetrated against Israel. You know, I got on Google, looked up, I put in August 22nd imam. You know how many things there were, which of course I didn't begin to look at all of them? 2.5 million. That's the most I've ever seen for a Google thing. So a lot of people know about this. A lot of people are aware of this. Pretty scary scenario. And how do you deal with this type of thing when people don't respond to normal warfare, you know, to the possibility of being killed? As this article in the Wall Street Journal asks, how then can one confront such an enemy with such a view of life and death? I'm going to depart from the seriousness of this for just a moment. Although this is serious, you may find it humorous, but it actually may be the very best way, maybe the only way to stop terrorists. It's entitled Fighting Swine with Swine by Hal Lindsey, by the way, whom some of you heard last night. I wish I could have been here to hear him, but anyway, it says it is still unclear exactly how to best fight against an enemy who wants to be killed. This is again written by Hal Lindsey. During World War II, we faced a similar enemy in the Japanese Imperial Forces. I mentioned the kamikaze fighters. But they were concentrated in islands where we could fulfill their death wish without hurting anyone else, whereas many of the terrorists live among us. In the light of that, we need to fight Muslims back with religiously effective weapons. In other words, we're dealing with a different mindset. Okay, people don't respond to normal threats of death. So he says we need to fight Muslims back with religiously effective weapons. Israeli police are considering using bags of pig lard in buses and other places to deter Muslim suicide bombers. In fact, the proposal has received the approval of the Jerusalem Rabbinate, whatever it is. rabbis, in other words. Rabbi Eliezer Moshe Fisher of the Jerusalem Rabbinical Court ruled yesterday that, quote, there is no halakhic ban on using bags of lard in buses and other places, unquote, when saving lives is concerned. Because, of course, you know, Jewish people have the same belief that this is unclean, okay? But the rabbis have a way of, you know, fixing things like that. You know, they can say, well, we'll make an exception in this. It'd be okay to do this if it's going to save lives of Israelis. The rabbi also said that if the police do not use pig fat in buses, tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews will arm themselves with spray guns filled with liquid lard to be used against terrorists. This sounds funny, but hang on. Strict Muslim tradition holds that any Muslim who comes in contact with a pig before dying will be denied access to heaven. There you go. That would work, right? But can you imagine the vanity of high monkey military resorting to this, doing away with our high-tech weapons and saying, okay, arm yourselves with pig lard? Well, the Israelis are. They're taking it seriously. And you know what? It probably will work. You know what else? It has worked. Go on in the article here. If bags of pig lard will prevent zealous Muslim terrorists from carrying out attacks, I'm all for it, said Deputy Internal Security Minister Yaakov Erdi in response to the plan. In October, former Chief Rabbi Mordecai Elihu and Kiryat Arba's Chief Rabbi Dov Lior, man, this is a tough sermon here. These weird names. Gave their endorsement to a proposal to test the use of wild pigs in detecting terrorist infiltrators and explosives in West Bank communities. The idea is not a new one. Just before World War I, General Blackjack Pershing, you've probably heard of him, was stationed in the Philippines where he was ordered to put down an Islamic insurgency movement. Pershing's troops captured 50 terrorists and had them tied to posts for execution. Pershing ordered his men to slaughter two pigs in front of the now horrified terrorists. The soldiers soaked their bullets in pig's blood in full view of the 50 condemned terrorists. Using the pig-soaked bullets, they executed 49 of them by firing squad. They dug a big hole, dumped in the bodies of the terrorists, and covered them in pig blood, entrails, etc., and covered over the grave. Pershing let the 50th terrorist go. There wasn't another Islamic terrorist incident for 42 years. Yeah, there you go. Last year, the Russians began wrapping the bodies of Chechen terrorists in pigskin before burial. It has had a significant effect on acts of terrorism against the Russian state by Islamic terrorists. Since the Muslim fundamentalists launched their suicide attacks against the United States and Israel, because of their firm belief that they will immediately go to paradise to be welcomed by their 72 black-eyed virgins, it follows that they would be terrified by anything that their religious faith tells them would prevent them from going to paradise. A devout Muslim fundamentalist does believe that if he touches anything from a pig at death, he is doomed forever. So may I introduce the new secret super weapon against Muslim terrorist missiles and airburst bombs filled with pig parts. There should be special public ceremonies in which our bullets are baptized in pig's blood. I really do believe that this would immediately suppress their jihad fervor and strike terror into their hearts. Nations like Italy and Poland that produce a large amount of pig products would be only too glad for us to have the pig manure and other byproducts for use in anti-jihad weapons. One could call it fighting swine with swine. Well, you know, it sounds sort of tongue-in-cheek in a way, but I mean, it documents that historically this has worked. You know, I mean, you have to deal with the kind of mentality of people you're dealing with, and I wonder how many so-called experts are really aware of that. You know, I heard a man who actually was in worldwide, I think, at one time, went to Ambassador College, and he was an expert in cults. And back when the situation in Waco regarding, what was the guy's name? David Koresh, yeah. You know, the government really blundered that really badly because the guy prophesied that we're all going to perish in flames. So the stupid governmental forces went in and just fulfilled the guy's prophecy. And what this guy said was, you know, what should have happened is, he said, I could have done this myself. So anybody could have gone up and convinced this guy that the Bible tells you that you need to surrender. See? Because that's what he believes. He doesn't care about, you know, perishing in flames. That just fulfilled his prophecies. Same thing is true with terrorism, with the Muslim religion. They believe these things are going to happen. In fact, this president of Iran is trying to make it happen sooner. They're bringing on. The Bible talks about hastening the day of the Lord. Well, they have their own ideas of how to do that by this global conflagration, even if it means destruction of their own people, because that just means they'll, you know, go to paradise just that much sooner. This is what we're dealing with. It's pretty scary. It's not the normal type of thing that we have dealt with in times past. And unless, you know, the United States and others really take something like this seriously, and more importantly, unless God spares us, it could be pretty scary times ahead of us. Well, do these events have anything to do with end-time prophecy, or are they just false alarms that we don't need to be concerned with? I mean, after all, there have been a lot of other threats. This is not the first time that God's people nationally have been threatened. You know, one notable example in the Bible is the threat of from the Haman, you know, mentioned in the book of Esther. Not only mentioned, but the major story of the whole book, how that God spared them at that time as a result of Esther being queen. And, of course, Esther was Jewish, and quite a fascinating story. I don't have time to cover that now, but that came to naught. There have been others that have taken place. Some have succeeded very much. Hitler in World War II slaughtered 6 million Jews. Still fell short of his desire to annihilate the whole race, you might say, the whole of Jewish culture. But still, he had very great success. And most of them have failed. And we can say, well, you know, there's nothing in prophecy about that. I mean, we need to worry about the beast power, don't we? We don't have to worry about a bunch of Arabs, Muslims. Well, I wouldn't be so sure about that. Let's take a look at some of the prophetic things and see what could happen. I'm not saying or predicting anything because, first of all, world news and prophecy are not my forte. And in second place, you know, experts in prophecy don't have a whole lot of credibility. It's kind of like political experts. No one would have forecast the Berlin Wall coming down, you know. Things happen that defy experts. So anyway, so two strikes against me. I'm not an expert, and even experts don't know the answers. But I just want to put up some possibilities here, things to think about. Daniel chapter 2, first of all, this is certainly a framework for end time prophecy that we're very familiar with. We've seen it probably so many times you could see it with your eyes closed, and articles, television programs, things like that. The dream of Nebuchadnezzar regarding four world ruling empires. It's Daniel, the second chapter. I'm not going to read all through the whole thing here, but just skip down to verse 31, which gives the interpretation that Daniel gave by God's inspiration to the king. He said, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs and of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay." We talked about this in Bible study recently. "You watched while a stone was cut off without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were crushed together and became like chaff before the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." Okay, this is the dream. Now we'll tell you the interpretation. "You, O king, are a king of kings. For the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." So then, end of verse 38 says, make a long story short, "You are this head of gold. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours, then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron, partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." So as we covered in the Bible study, it says that the 10 nations will be together with the beast only 1 hour, which doesn't literally mean 60 minutes, but it means a very short time. And you can do this experiment at home very safely. Take some nice shiny iron and some clay, you know, that's wet, stick it on the iron and hold it up and see how long it stays on there. And even after it dries, of course, it doesn't stick at all. So that's what it says it's going to be like. And furthermore, the other analogy, of course, is that some of the nations are strong like iron, and some of the nations will be a part of it, will be as weak as clay. But there's this aspect of not really adhering to one another. So in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms and shall stand forever. Inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands and the broken pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain and its interpretation is sure. And something about that just sounds very reassuring to read those words. This is not a prediction that might happen. It says, this is going to happen. You know, read my lips, take it to the bank, whatever you want to say. It is going to happen. Well, we know, probably all of us in here, I could ask you, I don't want to embarrass anybody, but probably you all know that these represent four nations in history, four empires, I should say, in secular history. The Babylonian Empire, headed by Nebuchadnezzar, was the first one. The second one was the Medo-Persian Empire. The third one was the Greek or Greco-Macedonian Empire. And the fourth one was the Roman Empire. Well, I don't see the Middle East in there, right? Well, hold on. And why these? Why not Egypt and others? Why these four? Well, because two reasons probably. All of them relate to Israel. Bible prophecy focuses on the nation of Israel because Israel nationally are God's people. And they all are in the same area of the world. Guess where? The Middle East. That's where all these were located. Look at your maps. Babylonia is what nation today, by the way? Anybody know? What modern nation? Iraq. So much for the idea of Middle East is not in prophecy. What about Persia? What's that today? Iran. Those are the two leading nations in the news today. They were the first two world-ruling empires. And then after that, you have, first two. After that, you have the Greco-Macedonian. That was taken over by the Roman Empire, but it still is that same area of the world. Okay, same nations. It was just different empires or different, you might say, political powers that took over these nations. Well, you have in Daniel chapter 7 then a similar prophecy, which was same conclusions, but as a result of a dream of Daniel himself. Daniel, the 7th chapter. Okay, I'm going to kind of skip through this here, but it mentions verse 1 that Daniel had a dream and visions on his bed. And he spells out the details here. Verse 2, Daniel spoke, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. That would be the Mediterranean Sea, right around that area there where these things took place. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off and it was lifted from the earth, made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. This is all talking about Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian Empire. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side, had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. So this was the Medo-Persian Empire. And the third one then mentions here, it was like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. This was the Greco-Macedonian Empire. A lot more details in this we don't have time to cover. I can give you resources. In fact, I'll mention one right now that would be very good to read, the Middle Eastern Bible Prophecy. If you haven't read this recently or haven't read it at all, I really recommend it because it's like a commentary on today's news. After this, verse 7, I saw in night visions, behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. Residue meaning the remainder. It was different from all the beasts that were before it and had 10 horns. And again, this is what we've been going through in the Bible study in Revelation. I was considering the horns. There was another horn, a little one coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous things. Then he mentions he watched until thrones were put in place and the Ancient of Days was seated, and describing God there, of course, replacing these governments with the kingdom of God on earth. Verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, that is, these other empires, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. So, you know, again today, we have nations that are outgrowth of those previous empires, in Iraq and Iran in particular. Okay, then he gives the explanation starting down in verse 17, those great beasts, which are four, are four kings or four kingdoms, which will arise out of the earth. Same four we talked about in Daniel chapter 2. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then he asked about the truth about the fourth beast. And verse 21, he said, I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. This, of course, again, ties in with what we've been covering in Bible study and Revelation. Until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of, or judgment was given to, it could be, the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. This whole description here is talking about that fourth world ruling empire, which we have understood to be identified with Rome in its resurrections called the Holy Roman Empire. And we're not alone in that understanding either, as far as that's concerned. Then Daniel goes on in chapter 8, and we read here about the events that took place in the taking over the Babylonian Empire by the Medo-Persian Empire. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. And I saw in the vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision I was by the river Ulai, which doesn't mean anything just today, probably. But then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram which had two horns. This represented the Medes and the Persians. It was a twofold empire there. But one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward. That will have significance a little bit later. Northward and southward, so that no beast could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram, and he was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. This is all talking about Alexander the Great, who is a Greek general that came in and took over that same empire that was previously headed by the Medes and the Persians. Therefore, verse 5, the male goat grew very great, but when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in the place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Now, that's very interesting because you read in history, and by the way, another, we don't have this in the library, I thought I got it, but I apparently didn't. There's a book titled A Handbook of Ancient History by Dorothy Ruth Miller. That has a commentary, a historical commentary, that explains Daniel 8, Daniel 9, 10, 11, in there from history. And a lot of that is covered in the book that we have, Middle East and Bible Prophecy. And a lot of good information is also in the Expositor's Bible Commentary. And we do have an abridged version of that sitting right up on top of the bookcase back there. And in fact, there are a lot of quotes in that commentary, which is I've often recommended. It's a very good one. A lot of quotes in that in our booklet here about the Middle East. So I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. That's not my purpose today. But anyway, out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land, verse 9. And it grew up to the host of the heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away. And the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. Now, what we're dealing with here is mentioned more than once throughout this section here of Daniel chapter 9 and also later on as well in Daniel chapter 11 is referred to as the abomination of desolation. This one horn that came up bigger than the others. The individual in history that fulfilled this, is his name, as you probably heard before, is Antiochus Epiphanes. Eventually what happened was after Alexander died, his empire died prematurely, actually. His empire was divided up amongst his four leading generals. Eventually it pretty much boiled down to two leading forces, one in the north and one in the south. North and south being north of Jerusalem, south of Jerusalem. So you had, first of all, the areas which today are Iraq and Iran, which was in the north. Then you had Egypt, which was in the south. The Egyptian area was basically the Ptolemy family, spelled P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. And then the kingdom of the north was the Seleucids, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D. And from this family came the different Antiochus individuals. There were more than one Antiochus, but it was Antiochus IV called Epiphanes that was the one that did this thing called the Abomination of Desolation. And what that was very similar to what I just read from Hal Lindsey. They defiled the sanctuary by putting in things that were unclean. In this particular case, they put in apparently a statue, a pagan statue, and a number of things that defiled the sanctuary. And this is all covered as well in the booklet, a lot of the details with regard to that. In fact, I'll read you just one quote here. This is speaking of Daniel 11, 21 through 35, which mentions this event again. These verses speak of the infamous Antiochus IV, also known as Epiphanes, the brother of Seleucus IV, who had earlier been taken hostage to Rome. He was a tyrannical oppressor who did his utmost to destroy the Jewish religion altogether. That's a quote from Expositor's Bible Commentary. Antiochus passed laws that forbade the practice of the Jewish religion under the penalty of death. He was a man of incredible cruelty. On his orders, an aged scribe, Eleazar, was flogged to death because he refused to eat swine's flesh. A mother and her seven children were successively butchered in the presence of the governor for refusing to pay homage to an image. Two mothers who had circumcised their newborn sons were driven through the city and cast headlong from the wall. This verse refers to the momentous events of December 16, 168 BC, when a crazed Antiochus entered Jerusalem and killed 80,000 men, women, and children. He then desecrated the temple by offering a sacrifice to the chief god Zeus. So this is the original fulfillment. Now, you know, you think of that kind of cruelty, and it sounds very similar to what you hear coming out of the Middle East today, doesn't it? Especially by this president of Iran. I don't have quotes with me, but he has many, many times said that he's going to annihilate Israel. In fact, one of the sources was on a blog. You see a lot of those on the internet. And it had a bunch of quotes from him, and it also had quotes from Adolf Hitler about the Jews. And it was an amazing similarity for perhaps a very understandable reason. The difference was that Hitler was not somebody who believed in the paradise that the Muslims talk about. So it's an even worse situation today. Well, anyway, that's the first fulfillment of this particular abomination desolation. But why is that important for us today? Anybody know? I mean, why do we have to be concerned about the abomination desolation? It's going to happen again. As the booklet says, this outrage was the forerunner of a comparable event that Jesus Christ said would occur in the last days. And we'll get to that here before we finished as well. So anyway, here we're talking once again about things that happened down in the area of the Middle East and the abomination of desolation in particular. In fact, there's a holy day that celebrates the victory of the Maccabees, which basically restored the temple again. It's called the Feast of Purim. It's celebrated this day because of the fact that the Maccabees were able to finally overthrow this evil power. So verse 13 then of chapter 8, then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days. Now I have a little number one before that in my New King James. The margin says 2,300 evenings and mornings. So actually we're talking about half of that time, because there are sacrifices offered in the morning and the evening, and it was the sacrifices that were done away with at that time, right? So we're talking about 2,300 sacrifices which are done twice a day. So the time period is 1,150 days. How many years would that be, you suppose? A little over 3 years. Less than 3.5 years, a little less than that. And what are your 3.5 years? Book of Revelation, right? There are a lot of things that happen in a 3.5 year period. Some of them not for the entire length of time. Okay, so there we have that situation that had a forerunner, historic forerunner, but also an end time one as well. Verse 16, going on, says, I heard a man's voice between the banks of this river who called and said, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, son of man, that the vision refers to, look at, time of the end. It's not just something that happened long ago that has no relationship to now. It refers to the time of the end. Verse 19, and he said, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For the appointed time, the end shall be. The ram which you saw, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, as we mentioned before. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn is between his eyes as the first king. That was Alexander the Great. As for the broken horn, the four that stood up in his place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. This I have a chart in my Bible here from this book by Dorothy Ruth Miller. Names the generals. You know, we know who they are from history. Okay, verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. Does it sound like this guy in Iran to you? It does to me. Now, you know, our understanding is, at some point in here, it shifts over to the beast power in Europe. Okay, maybe so, but what if... maybe there's something we're not taking into account there. And could there be more than one? I mean, could this describe this man too? Well, obviously it could. It's in that area of the world. His power shall be mighty, verse 24, but not his own power. What do you suppose that means? What power are we talking about? Power of Satan the devil. And now Satan has always tried to destroy God's people. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. You know, one of the things that's happening in Lebanon right now, the difficulty of the Hezbollah, you know what? They're the ones doing the rebuilding. Of course, it's stupid people don't stop realizing, yeah, but who bombed them in the first place? Or who caused the bombing? You know, they went in and provoked Israel and started this war by... and so they don't care that the things are bombed, but they come in like the good guys. They're like, okay, you know, we're going to fix these all up. Look how good we are. Reminds me of what they say about television commercials, that, you know, they offer you the things that get you sick and then the other things that get you well, too, at the same time. So that's what we're dealing with here. So his powers shall be mighty, but not his own power. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. That's Israel, who is prime minister, the president, rather, of Iran, threatening to destroy Israel and the United States, by the way, as well. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Now this is why people say, well, this is talking about the beast power, because he's the one that's going to be, you know, the great end time false prophet's going to rise against Christ. And it says he'll be destroyed without human hand. And that's pretty flimsy to just shift gears all of a sudden to the, you know, to the beast power or the end time false prophet, just because it says he'll stand against the prince of princes. Does that mean literally standing up against Christ at his return? Well, that's the way we understand it. But, you know, it doesn't have to mean that. It can mean somebody that opposes true Christianity. Do the Muslims oppose Christianity? You bet they do. Now, it says he'll be destroyed not by a human hand, so that would mean that God would take him out, which he can do. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be that end time situation. So I'm just saying, okay, look, that's a possibility. I don't rule it out. Again, I'm in thin ice because it's not my forte, but I'm just saying don't put all your eggs in one basket. Say, well, we don't have to worry about this guy in Iran because it's the beast and false prophet we have to worry about. Based on our understanding, yeah, but there's a lot more in the Bible that perhaps could indicate some other things as well. The vision of the evenings and mornings which was told is true, therefore seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. And, of course, specifically talking about events in the end time. Okay, in Daniel chapter 9, you got the 70 weeks prophecy. And I honestly don't ready to finish the transgression, make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. No one understands that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 2 weeks, which is 69. Verse 26, after the 62-week period, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and his end shall be defiled. What does that have to do with Christ? Now, our understanding has been that this is referring to the ministry of Jesus Christ, and he's cut off in the middle of the week, sacrificed in the middle of the week, and he causes sacrifices and oblations to cease. And verse 27 says, he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Okay, so a week is 7 days. Day for a year, 7 years. Christ was put to death after what? 3.5 year ministry. Very nice. But is that the total answer to 7 weeks prophecy? What about, we read about earlier, causing sacrifices and offerings to cease? Was by Antiochus Epiphanes, right? And how do these other things fit here about the people, the prince, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary? Jesus didn't do that. So another school of thought is this is talking about an end time. The word Messiah just means an anointed one. That's capitalized in your Bible because people think it's talking about Christ. But there are other anointed ones, special anointed. Cyrus was called a Messiah, an anointed one. So I honestly don't know which understanding we have on that now, and I know that it's still not something that we are totally sure about. Because right in the middle here, the context is talking about the abomination of desolation. Look at end of verse 27. He shall bring an end to the sacrifice and offering, and on the wings of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation which is determined is poured out on the desolate, the desolator. So that looks like you were talking about this guy, you know, who's putting an end to sacrifices, not talking about Christ. So, you know, again, I don't know which one it is. And I don't think any of us can say with certainty. It could be both. You know, it could be a type by opposite involved there. But it's very possible that we have more information there with regard to the Middle East. In Daniel chapter 10, notice on the heading, if you have a New King James, it's the beginning of verse 10, it says prophecies concerning Persia and Greece. Persia is what? It's Iran today. So it says, then suddenly a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and the palms of my hands. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And while he was speaking this word, I stood trembling. And he said, don't fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. I've come because of your words. But, notice verse 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I had been left alone there with the kings of Persia. Why does he keep mentioning Persia all the time? Why is he talking about the prince of Persia? You know who that is? That's a high-ranking angel, apparently, demon spirit, that has to do with Persia, which today is Iran. That demon no longer around? Demons live forever. Well, what's the significance of that, you know? There it is again. Context, verse 14. I've come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision refers to many days yet to come. Then you have a whole chapter, and this, again, I won't get into detail at all in this, but in Daniel chapter 11, you have a lot talked about with regard to the king of the north and the king of the south. And that really gets tricky because they got all these pronouns, he and him and so forth, and it goes back and forth. And I went through a study one time based upon this book here that I mentioned by Dorothy Ruth Miller and the article we had back in Worldwide on the Middle Eastern prophecy. And I did a single underline for the King of the North and a double underline for the King of the South. But you start reading through that, it really gets complicated. But again, it's talking about those areas in the Middle East. North of Jerusalem, south of Jerusalem. Okay, and you can document this in history. Once again, our booklet goes through that as well as this booklet and also the Expositor's Bible Commentary. Right on through, it's a fascinating history of these battles that took place between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, including, of course, Antiochus, who was one of those as well. But then you come down to a certain point there, and things, by our understanding, shift gears. Down about verse 32 here, those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Right before that, though, is the mention once again of the abomination of desolation. That's in verse 31. Forces shall be mustered by him, that would be the king of the north in this particular case, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. And this again in history was done by Antiochus, who was one of the rulers of the north, the kingdom of the Seleucids, and actually that is Syria. The king of the south was Egypt, and this at this time was Syria. That doesn't mean it has to be that way the whole time, but it's an area north of Jerusalem. So then down, we read verse 32. In verse 33, those of the people who understand will instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame by captivity and plundering. So this historically could be referring to the Maccabees, who are the ones responsible for finally overthrowing this power. Verse 35, some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, to purge them and make them white until the time of the end, because it's still for the appointed time. Somewhere in there, though, our booklet makes this statement with regard to this. Let's find the particular point here. It says, and this is commentary on verses 32 through 35 in our booklet, indeed, at this point, Daniel's prophecy definitely takes on a different tone, referring explicitly to the time of the end near the end of verse 35. See, we just read that, until the time of the end. To quote expositors, and this is a quotation from the commentary here, with the conclusion of the preceding pericope, which means an extract, at verse 35, the predictive material that incontestably applies to the Hellenistic empires and the contest between the Seleucids and the Jewish patriots ends. This present action section, rather, verses 36 through 39, contains some features that hardly apply to Antiochus IV. That's the one that did the abomination of desolation, though most of the details could apply to him as well as to his latter antitype, the beast. So they're saying, too, okay, now we're shifting this over, and it's no longer the king of the north is no longer Syria and the king of the south, Egypt. Now the king of the north is the resurrected Roman Empire, because, you see, the territory was taken over after the Greeks was taken over by the Romans. So the reasoning is, okay, now so the king of the north, which is still north of Jerusalem, refers to the beast power. The only problem with that is that the king of the south is in the Middle East. And if that's Iraq and Iran, that's not south of Jerusalem. It's south of Europe. But the focal point of prophecy is Jerusalem. So that poses a little bit of a problem I don't know if we've ever thought about before. But that's our understanding. That's the understanding of pretty much of other prophetic sources, as well as that, including a commentary up there as well. Goes on to say, both liberal and conservative scholars, quoting from the commentary, agree that all of chapter 11 up to this point contains strikingly accurate predictions of the whole sweep of events from the reign of Cyrus to the unsuccessful effort of Antiochus Epiphanes to stamp out the Jewish faith. But from this point forward, a little more than a century would pass before Roman general Pompey would conquer Jerusalem, and much of the Middle East passed to the control of the Roman Empire, and much of its power in turn passed to its eastern leg, the Byzantine Empire, in the following centuries. But then, as we'll see in this next chapter of the booklet, says, remarkable new power and religion arose on the scene to dominate the Middle East for centuries, the Islamic Empire, and there are whole chapters about Islam. So the struggle has been since you, and I didn't even factor in here another very important thing in history, and that's the Crusades. Okay? The Crusades were who against who? Europe against Muslims. So that would tie in then with King of the North versus King of the South. If that is appropriate to make that switcheroo there, see? Because Rome took over that territory, so now it's not Syria versus Egypt, it's Europe versus whoever this King of the South is. Maybe, maybe not. But one way or the other, the Middle East is still there. Islamic Empire is still there. And our booklet makes that very, very clear. So you still are dealing with, once again, the Middle East and with Islamic powers. Now the thing is, the Islamic Empire is divided. However, and that's one of the problems. I mean, it's amazing that Israel, a small nation it is, has been able to hold itself, hold its own against all these other powers around. And one of the reasons is because these other powers are not united, and they fight against each other. Even now there's a power struggle in the ranks of terrorists, you know. But you notice that someone's becoming very prominent down there in the Islamic nations. Who would that be? Who do you suppose? Mr. Unpronounceable, right? In Iran. Is becoming very, very prominent. They're the ones that everybody pretty well knows. They're the ones financing Hezbollah down in Lebanon to fight Israel. So if they could pull together, you know, these, or he could, let's say, pull together these other Islamic nations, things could get really, really bad in a hurry, especially for the nation, small nation of Israel and the United States. You know, if you notice that in quotes that some of these Islamic individuals use, they refer to the to us as what? The Crusaders. What are they talking about? In their minds, the Crusades have never ended. You know, Melvin Rhodes, the same person who wrote this, and I would recommend this very highly too if you haven't read it yet, in the latest Good News magazine, What Motivates Ahmadinejad, by Melvin Rhodes. He did an incredible sermon we showed here a couple years ago. That he brought this out, that the conflict in the Middle East is nothing new. It's the Crusades still going on. It's Christianity versus the Muslim religion. And so that's what you're dealing with still today. The difference is back then it was Europe versus the Middle East. Today the leading force in the West is the United States. And now the nation of Israel is a separate nation right in the middle of all these hostile Arabs who want to put them out of existence. But it's the same battle going on. So that's what we're dealing with still today. And in their minds, it's even clearer than it is in our minds. Okay, well, I want to refer to one other verse here then, and that's verse 40 of Daniel chapter 11. At the time of the end, so now we're dealing with not something that happened long ago in history, but literally the time of the end. The king of the south shall attack him, that's the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him, would be the king of the south, like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land. That would be what? Exactly. The nation of Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, prominent people of Ammon, which is Jordan. You know what? Jordan is not involved trying to attack Israel. They're basically good guys by comparison. So it's fascinating how this plays out. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He goes on to talk about it. So what are we talking about here? Well, our understanding is the king of the south, of course, it would be the Islamic nations, the Arab nations. King of the north would be Europe. That's the case. This king of the south that says attacks him. The old King James says pushes. The word is used for a ram. That, remember I said that earlier? With the ram that pushed all these different directions back there in Daniel chapter 8. It's referring to what a ram does with its horns. It kind of pushes. It can refer to attack, but it also can refer to something different. I found this online. I found it very fascinating. It's called the Forerunner Commentary. Probably none of you ever heard of it. I'd never heard of it before. It's amazing what you can find online. But this is a commentary on these passages, verses 40 through 42. Students of Bible prophecy have often wondered about the role of the king of the south in the end time. Daniel 11 describes the back and forth fighting and intrigue between the Seleucid Empire based in Syria, the king of the north, and the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt, the king of the south. Obviously, during the time of their conflict, these nations were north and south of Jerusalem, respectively, and their battlegrounds were often in the land of Israel. Neither of these two empires exists any longer. However, verse 40 speaks of the time of the end, meaning the period just before the return of Jesus Christ. Which nations, then, are the kings of the north and south? Because the Roman Empire swallowed up both of the older empires, it could at one time have been said to be both. However, Diocletian split the Roman Empire into eastern and western halves in AD 284 and 324. And in 324, Constantine established the eastern capital at Byzantium, renamed Constantinople, now Istanbul, first in Turkey. The Western Empire fell in 476 to be succeeded down the centuries by several resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. It sounds like something we'd write, doesn't it? The Eastern Empire, however, proved more enduring, lasting until 1453 when the Turks under Mehmed II took the weak and tired city of Constantinople after a 53-day siege. Once again, there were rival kings of north and south, though this event merely formalized an ongoing struggle between Christian Europe and Muslim Middle East. It's your Crusades again, right? This situation remains intact today. Even now, we are witnessing the bitter and violent conflict between the Western and Islamic civilizations. Notice in verse 40 that the King of the North invades and conquers countries, suggesting that the King of the South is composed of several nations, much like the modern Middle East. The King James Version uses push at him instead of attack him, and this is to be preferred, as the Hebrew verb means to thrust. Like I said, a ram does with its horns, it thrusts, okay? It could be an attack, military attack, but it could equally be an economic, religious, or cultural assault. Whatever it is, the King of the North reacts to it swiftly and forcefully. So basically it's saying something as King of the South does provokes the King of the North. It could be a monumental increase in oil prices, right? That could do it. It could be a nuclear attack on Israel or the United States. And that really cuts the purse strings, among other things, of Europe. So it could be anything, not necessarily a military attack. We should also note verses 41 through 42. In them, God directs our attention to the area targeted by the King of the North. The glorious land, the land of Israel, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, all three part of modern Jordan and Egypt. It is clear that if this prophecy speaks of our day, the King of the South is represented by the Arab peoples of the Middle East. Could we be seeing this prophecy beginning to come to pass? Perhaps the ways of predominantly Muslim immigrants into Europe have woken the emerging colossus of the North to some of the troubles the clash of cultures can cause. If these problems should be combined with terrorist attacks on European soil of the magnitude of the September 11 bombings, an armed response would seem unavoidable. However, the leader, the person, whoever is the king of the North, is still lacking. No strong man has stood up in Europe to take the lead in solving some of these problems. The stage, though, is being set for such a ruler to galvanize both the leadership and citizenry of Europe to unite to fight against the enemies of their civilization. See Revelation 17, verses 9 through 14. Though it is probably not the catalyst, Europe's immigration woes could provide some of the fuel for the coming conflagration. This is an area on which Christians should keep a watchful eye. That makes it sound pretty close to our day and time, doesn't it? When you read it in the Bible, it's one thing, but when you read this commentary saying, you know what, this is what we see happening right now in the news in the Middle East, it makes you realize it's something, as he said, we really need to keep our eyes on. Well, you know, there are several 3.5-year periods in Revelation. I won't turn there for sake of time. We need to get this closed here, but times of Gentiles are mentioned in there as Jerusalem will be trodden down by Gentiles for 3.5 years. That's mentioned in Revelation 11. That's also mentioned in Luke chapter 21. Okay, I'm going to do about three more scriptures and close on one here. Luke chapter 21. You usually think of the abomination of desolation in terms of something that happens in the holy place. That's one of the ones we'll read here in a moment. But Luke 21, verse 20 through 24 says, "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, know this desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things that are written may be fulfilled." And verse 24 says, they will fall by the edge of the sword, be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles to the times the Gentiles are fulfilled. This is 3.5 year period of time at the very end that Jerusalem is going to be surrounded by armies, as it mentions here. Of course, what else is new? They've been surrounded by armies so many times, but which armies is it? Is it armies from Europe? Is it armies perhaps from the Middle East? One thing I think I can stick my neck out and say, I don't believe that the nation of Israel is going to be totally destroyed by nuclear warfare. You know why? Well, not only because God wouldn't allow it, but also because Jerusalem is a holy site to Muslims and Catholics, as well as Christians. So I really don't think that they're going to destroy a holy site. Because otherwise you might say, why would armies surround Jerusalem? They can just send one nuclear missile and get rid of them all. Well, because Jerusalem, they'd have to send armies down so they don't harm the holy places. So this is right up to date of what eventually is going to happen. One other one then on this time period here is in Matthew 24, mentioning once again the abomination of desolation. Matthew 24, and starting verse 15, therefore when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those which are in Judea flee in the mountain to the mountains. So it's the same time period, obviously, we just read in Luke 21 about armies surrounding Jerusalem. Some aspect of the abomination of desolation is going to reoccur. But the fact that it says, let him who reads understand, tells me there's more there than meets the eye. Don't say, oh, we know what that's going to be. I believe that we will know what it will be when it happens, because Daniel was told in Daniel 12, verse 10, the wise shall understand. But I'll tell you, I don't think we know now. And I don't think we can just glibly say, well, we know what that's going to be because of this statement here. So it mentions then, verse 21, then shall be great tribulation such as not since the beginning of the world to this time, no one ever shall be. So that's one of the things that will take place to watch for in the news in terms of this, whatever it is, it's going to happen once again to bring on the abomination of desolation. One thing to remember is this was done by an Arab power before, right? And down that area. Antiochus, okay? Done that by someone from that area. So it could be done by somebody in Europe in the future, or if we're not correct, maybe it will be done by these Arab powers. They might decide to fight swine with swine as well, if you want to put it that way. So when it comes to pass, we'll know, we'll recognize it, even though whether we understand it now or not. One other scripture I want to point to here, which is, it's scary to me, it really is, Revelation 20 and verse 4. Once again, you know, we can read these things in the Bible sitting here comfortably. You might be a little restless by now because it's about time to quit, but you know what? It's nothing compared with the times that are coming. And this particular passage in particular, had a thought about it I want to share with you. It says, verse 24 of chapter 20, I saw thrones, they sat on them, judgment was committed to them. You know, we read about that in Daniel's prophecy. I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus, for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image and had not received his mark on their foreheads or on their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. The assumption is it's talking about people who are put to death by the beast power. Okay, fine. Could it be anything else in addition to that? I mean, obviously, the people that don't worship the mark or the image of the beast, that's talking about the beast power very clearly. Well, what about people who are beheaded for the witness to Jesus and the word of God? Could that be separate people martyred by others? Why would a professing Christian organization have a problem with somebody witnessing to Christ and the word of God? Who would have a problem with that? The Muslims. Who's beheading people these days? Muslims. You know, that's pretty scary. And you read about in the newspaper, people have been beheaded. Now, I know back in the Inquisitions, and we're thinking Inquisition here, you know, that was France, they had the guillotine and everything. That's a long time ago. Now, who's doing the beheading is the Muslims. And they would be the ones that would have a problem with somebody being a Christian. Because in their prophecies, hey, you know, Islam has to be the, or Muslim religion has to be the dominant religion in the world. And we're enemies. It's the Crusades all over again. So don't rule out the Arabs. Don't rule out the Muslims in end time prophecy, because there's an awful lot that the Bible says, and maybe more that could be said in terms of their involvement in events in the Middle East. And above all, don't allow yourself to be lethargic or complacent simply because there are not 10 nations in Europe and because Jews are not yet offering sacrifices. You know, I pull out something else off the internet that's short and I'll share with you, and I think really kind of illustrates what I would like to say as well. This is a guy who plans to give a sermon on the subject. He said, "Today the shaky ceasefire in the Israeli-Hezbollah war has been declared. If the ceasefire holds, it will only be a pause before the coming storm between America and Israel and the rogue nation of Iran. If you compare world history from 1935 until 1939, we are reliving that era. In that era, Hitler pledged to kill the Jews, and the people of the free world were trying to come to grips with the rise of Hitler's dictatorship and the threat to democracy. Only Winston Churchill got it right. Remember all the people are trying to reason Chamberlain's in peace in our time, all that kind of stuff, you know? We are in a very similar period. The people of America do not want to admit Islamofascism is a threat to this nation. It is. They don't want to believe that Iran could use nuclear weapons against mighty America. They will. America was attacked on 9/11 by Islamic fanatics who intend to destroy this nation. Few Americans ever stop to consider that losing this war will mean to every one of us. It is time for every spiritual leader in this nation to shake ourselves out of the stupor called political correctness and to clearly and forcefully address the fact that we are at war with Islamic fanatics who intend to destroy the United States of America and Israel." And I'll tell you, you know, you can sit here in your comfort, but just stop and think. If it hadn't been for this almost fluke discovery of this plot to kill thousands of people in 10 airplanes over United States cities, what would that do to us? The only question is that we're here by the grace of God. But you know, that's not going to last forever. We know there's a tribulation coming. We dare not get caught up in you know, lethargy just simply because times are so good right now. Because our hope is, as I said, in the grace and mercy of God. Now, God has delivered his people many times throughout history in the face of threats of foreign nations. That's very true. So far, he has. He delivered us through World War II. He delivered us from Khrushchev, who banged his shoe on the table and says, "We'll bury you." Khrushchev is now dead and buried. Soviet Union is not what it used to be. The United States is still going strong. I saw a cartoon recently that showed bin Laden in a cave saying, "We will bury you." And here he is buried in the cave himself. Well, you know, there's still a lot of terrible things that are going to happen. There's a psalm that says, Psalm 2, "Why do the nations rebel?" I read this in New English Translation. "Why are the countries devising plots that will fail?" This is God's perspective, and I want to close on this positive because, you know, if there weren't a God, we could really be shaking in our boots right now. But God, you know, is one that I pray every day for God to restrain the things that some of these leaders are planning to do. So God says, "Why do the nations rebel? Why are the countries devising plots that will fail? The kings of the earth form a united front. The rulers collaborate against the Lord and his anointed king. They say, 'Let's tear off the shackles they put on us. Let's free ourselves from their ropes.' The one enthroned in heaven laughs in disgust. The Lord taunts them. Then he angrily speaks to them and terrifies them in his rage, saying, 'I myself have installed my king in Zion, my holy hill.' The king says, 'I will announce the Lord's decree. He said to me, "You are my son. This day I have become your father. Ask me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance.'" Of course, that's talking about the returning Messiah. "The ends of the earth as your personal property. You will break them with an iron scepter. You will smash them like a potter's jar. So now, you kings, do what is wise. You rulers of the earth, submit to correction. Serve the Lord in fear, repent in terror, give sincere homage. Otherwise, he will be angry and you will die because of your behavior when his anger quickly unites. How blessed are all who take shelter in him." So, you know, as terrible as these things are, we know from Bible prophecy, from what we're studying in the book of Revelation, in so many places, God says it's going to be very bad. But you know what? I'm going to take over. I'm going to destroy these powers, and I'm going to deliver my people. And the final verse says, "How blessed are all those who take shelter in him." Time will come when God will withdraw his protection from this nation. Be a time of martyrdom, saints, and great times of trial, even for those who are protected. We need to rely on the closing verse of this song, "How blessed are those who take shelter in him." Our hope for the future is squarely in God's hands. One more quote here from Psalm 91. This would be a good thing to hang on the wall. This is in the New English Translation as well. As for you, the one who lives in the shelter of the Sovereign One and resides in the protective shadow of the Mighty King, I say this about the Lord, my shelter and my stronghold, my God in whom I trust. He will certainly rescue you from the snare of the hunter and from the destructive plague. He will shelter you with his wings. You will find safety under his wings. His faithfulness is like a shield or a protective wall. You need not fear the terrors of the night, the arrow that flies by day, the plague that comes in the darkness, or the disease that comes at noon. Though a thousand may fall beside you, and a multitude on your right side, it will not reach you. Certainly you will see it with your very own eyes. You will see the wicked paid back. For you have taken refuge in the Lord, my shelter, the Sovereign One. No harm will overtake you, no illness will come near your home, for he will order his angels to protect you in all that you do. That will become a lot more meaningful as time goes along, folks, because when you look at the world scene, it's pretty scary. And we've dodged a bullet many, many times, thanks to God's mercy, but it's not going to last forever. Our best hope is looking to God and knowing that God loves his people, he'll deliver his people. And when it comes time for eternity, there's going to be some real shock, surprise people that are not going to find themselves in paradise. But if by God's mercy extends that far, we'll be brought up in the second resurrection and be taught the real paradise and the real God and the real Messiah, who is not the 10th, the 12th Imam.